30 years ago, the prevailing paradigm in measurement and test construction was classical test theory. Those of us who worked with construction of instruments used simple classical statistics such as the item p-values, point biserial, biserial correlations, and sometimes if we were very pragmatic, we used the index of discrimination. This paradigm, however, had some severe limitations, and one of the most noted limitations was that it lacked any sort of claim to yielding invariant item statistics or invariant item parameters. We simply couldn't calibrate items from large item pools onto a common scale unless they had all been responded to by the same set of examinees. And with large-scale testing programs looming ahead of us and the need for multiple forms and the interest in mapping developmental growth over time, it became more and more apparent that something more was needed. At about that time, Fred Lord, George Roche, developed new models that we now call lumped together under the rubric of item response theory that held out the promise of being able to accomplish that goal. Their efforts were extremely well proselytized by Ben Wright, Ron Hamilton, and many others who are in this room. And we embraced their work wholeheartedly and with great enthusiasm. Item response theory has become the prevailing paradigm for test construction, test development today. Now, if we look at Thomas Kuhn's criteria for what a prevailing paradigm is, it's really amazing how well these things fit. First of all, he says that the prevailing paradigm has to emerge as an achievement so unprecedented that it is able to attract an enduring group of adherents away from competing modes of scientific activity. Well, IRT models, both one, two, and three-parameter models, certainly accomplish that. Many of us dropped everything else we were doing and flocked to this camp. You can watch the steady immersion of numerous item response theory sessions in the NCME and AERA programs in the last 20 years. You can watch the contents of the journals change as item response theory became the method of choice for most of us. A second criteria of a prevailing paradigm is that it must be sufficiently open-ended to leave all sorts of problems for the newly converted to resolve. Well, it certainly seemed that as we adapted and adopted these new models, we did encounter many unresolved problems, and it created work and exciting work for many to do. I believe Ron's referred to the many papers that have been published in this area alone and the many hundreds, if not thousands, of researchers that have really dedicated their professional lives in the past few years to this effort. They're all going to rise up and chase me from the room before this session is over, I feel. Finally, the prevailing paradigm gains status as it leads to resolution of practical problems. Item response theory models did indeed do that. So now we are at a stage that Kuhn would refer to as normal science. The writings in this field have progressed from the initial descriptions of the Roche model, the three-parameter model, to now simple, not simple, but brief articles that are published in journals in arcane language shared by those who only subscribe to the paradigm. If you haven't bought into item response theory, it's very difficult to pick up any of the leading measurement journals today and make much sense out of it. We're engaged in what Kuhn would call mopping up. The models have been put before us. Now the bulk of the profession engages in mopping up work as we set about further articulating the models that have been presented to us and testing their limits. Now, the next normal stage of development, as everybody becomes engaged in wholesale mopping up, is that we begin to encounter anomalies. We begin to encounter sources of conflict. We begin to develop rival schools of thought about which is the appropriate way to go. Some of us begin to be disenchanted. Confusion may arise. Practitioners may feel frustrated as to which is the right direction to take. And I think today's debate really highlights the presence of these competing schools of thought and some of these anomalies. Now, within this framework, I'm going to now try to address what I think are some of the shortcomings of each of these approaches. I'm not going to take a side and say, yes, I'm for one or I'm for the other. I'm going to point out to you what I see as some of the problems. First of all, let me say I do agree with Ben that the Rosch model is aesthetic. It's consistent with some fundamental measurement scale and scaling theories that we find very appealing. It works well. It's easy to use. I fear, however, from my own experience, that it works too well. Ben has said that we need to find good data, data that fits the model, and then use that model appropriately. If I could find good data that I knew already fit the model and the theories, I'm not sure I would need the models. One of the uses that I make in test construction is to use these models to help me identify those items which are functioning the way I think they should, and to identify those items which are not functioning correctly. In other words, the basic step, before I get into equating or item bias or anything else, the basic step is to try to help me identify sound items that are measuring the trade I set out to measure without doing violence to the trade itself. Early in my use of the Rosch model, I had a simple little task in which I had a set of about five subsets of 25 items each, and I was merrily roshing them away. And in my carelessness, I switched the keys around so that I was applying the wrong keys, or the right keys, but to the wrong data. Everything seemed to be working out pretty well, however. And it wasn't until I began to examine the item characteristics, the classical item characteristics, of the items I was discarding that I became worried. And furthermore, I noticed that some items that would have caused me to scratch my head when I looked at their classical item statistics were remaining in the data set. Well, after a little bit of closer investigation, I realized that my problem was I was using the wrong key. But I didn't get that information from anything that I found in the printout. Everything seemed to be working well. The data did fit the model, but I think what happened was I was no longer measuring at all what I thought I was measuring, and we will let the trait that I was measuring go unmentioned for the moment. This has given me some lingering uneasiness about the claims that the model is easy to use and that it's robust. So that's worried me. Now, consequently, on the other side, a few months later, for a class exercise, one of my colleagues wanted to use similar data to do a demonstration with either Logist or Bilog, I don't recall which. And in my usual penchant for care, I handed him the data and again handed him an incorrect item key. Within 5 or 10 minutes, he was back saying to me, "Are you sure you gave me the right key? This isn't coming out well at all." My point is that at least with the three-parameter model, we knew something was amiss, and we knew it very soon. However, with the three-parameter model, there are lots of shortcomings, too. One of them is that the guessing parameter, which should be most of interest to those who are looking at items and looking at item misfunction and trying to figure out what's gone wrong, that guessing parameter is often poorly estimated. Another thing that bothers me is the scale shrinkage that's been observed by Yin in some of her vertical equating studies. This is a major anomaly. It's a concern. Particularly, it's a concern because if she's correct, the discrimination estimation begins to go awry as items become more complex. I think that's going to pose some real limitations for us. Another concern I have is that the scoring weights that we need to maximize information in three-parameter models require us to give different weights to different examinees who may answer the same items correctly. I would not want to find myself in court trying to defend that. Finally, my greatest concern is that achievement itself, as we wish to define it in broad educational domains, may not be amenable to assessment by these models. I think in boardrooms and state departments and some testing companies across the country, people are sometimes gathering together, looking at their data and their estimates from either of these models, scratching their heads and saying, "Gosh, this isn't working well. but not very many people are saying it out loud. My conclusion is that the clock is ticking on both of these models. They've been useful. They've moved us along. But the field is probably ready for the emergence of a new paradigm. And that discovery of that new paradigm is not going to be made by those who are engaged in a debate of which one is best, the one or the three-parameter model. Which should I use, Logist, Bilog, or Bicow? I think we're going to encounter some disillusionment and discouragement. I'm going to paraphrase here a quote from Wolfgang Pauli at a stage in physics when things seem bleak to him, and I'm going to substitute the word psychometrics. At the moment, psychometrics is again terribly confused. In any case, it is too difficult for me, and I wish I'd been a movie comedian instead and never heard of psychometrics. 5 months later, however, after the publication of Heisenberg's quantum theory, Pauli was to change his mind and say, "This theory has given me hope and joy in life. I hope that we'll all be so open to new theories as they come along that will allow us to build on these and acquire some hope and joy in life and not despair over the failures of either of these models." Thank you.
Thank you, Linda. Our next discussant will be Jeff Masters from the Australian Council for Educational Research.